You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Hi, Hugh. How are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Of course.
I start every episode with a question, but we're going to move this question to the end of the episode because I know there's a lot to unpack here. But, you know, basically, what does it mean to be Vietnamese? And hopefully we're going to unpack that as we go along in this episode. So what year were you born in the United States, or did you come as a baby, or?
So I was born in the 80s. I'm not going to like give away my real age. A woman never does, but yes, born like in the 80s. My parents were boat people, and so they came here in the middle of the night. Well, so they were boat people, and so they came to first Indonesia. And so that was actually where I was born. And I think that has kind of really influenced the way I've thought about my life. You know, like for me, like I wasn't born in it with a silver spoon in my mouth. Like I was born in a freaking refugee camp, and that kind of like, yeah, has influenced how I think about things and how, you know, I never take anything for granted. And so they were in the refugee camp for about a year and then went to Hong Kong, and that's where they got the green light to come over to America. And of all of the places that they could have ended up at was in this small southern town called Waycross, Georgia. And it was a group of church people who sponsored us over. And coincidentally, my parents still live here after almost 30, 40 years. And I keep coming back. So.
How far is that from Atlanta?
It is about 4 hours from Atlanta. So I like to say for people who haven't been to Georgia, like there's Atlanta and then there's the rest of Georgia, which is so completely different.
When they moved to that small town, mm-hmm. you're an infant, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so I grew up all my life in this small town, and we were literally like only a handful of Vietnamese families there. So growing up, I never really had, a sense of a Vietnamese community. And so that wasn't until like later as an adult that I experienced that.
Wow. So. Did your parents sort of hang out with the other Vietnamese families?
They did, you know, out of necessity, you know, but a lot of those families have moved away to Texas, to California, and my parents are literally the only remaining ones left. And, you know, and there's a story in that, there's a documentary in that, that I've been wanting to unpack for a couple years now, so.
Why do you think they stayed there and not moved to a bigger community of Vietnamese people?
You know, I think it comes from maybe from trauma, like having you know, risk their lives to move from one place to another. I don't know if they would ever want to take that risk anymore, because even here, it's like pulling teeth to try to get my parents to, you know, take a trip to Atlanta. And because I live in LA, like, I think it would take a lot of convincing for them to even get on a plane to come visit me.
Oh, so, they never did. They haven't been to LA or
Orange. Yeah, they haven't. Yeah.
Not even to Orange County.
No, they haven't. The last time they were on a plane was actually to my wedding in San Francisco. That was 5 years ago. So that was the last time they've been on a plane.
So when you're growing up, right? You're growing up in Georgia, and that's like one of the white states that you can grow up in.
Yeah.
What can you describe that?
It was, you know, like now, like I think being in it, you don't realize how different it is. It isn't until you step out of it and then you look at it, you know, in hindsight, and it was like, wow, we went through a lot, you know, like I'm kind of working on a couple of stories about growing up in this small southern town and like digging up those memories. And it was hard. I remember being in elementary school and being placed in speech therapy classes just because they didn't know what to do with me, because it wasn't that I had a speech impediment. It was just, I didn't know how to speak English. And so I should have been in ESL classes, you know. And then there were all these other like little microaggressions and a lot of, you know, you don't look like you belong around here, you know. And I mean, I think I still always felt Vietnamese. I still, because at home I would have to speak Vietnamese to my parents, or I wouldn't be able to communicate. And so, so I'm glad I have that, you know, the language at least. So.
So when you're growing up, you know, I think, CNN is out of Atlanta, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did that
mm-hmm.
have anything to do with you wanting to become somebody working in the that business?
Growing up, I always wanted to be like an artist. Like I drew a lot in high school, and I wrote a lot. I wasn't on my newspaper in high school, anything like that. The idea of journalism as a career didn't even register. But I knew that if I wanted to get out of my like small town trappings, then the only option was kind of Atlanta. So, and CNN was kind of like the only option if I wanted to be in journalism, just because, you know, the monomyth minority, we have to be at the best. And so CNN is literally, you know, the best, I think, news organization out there. So
what was your journey like to get there?
Like I've said, like growing up, I never ever thought I would be in journalism. I mean, I knew I wanted to do something creative, but at the same time, I knew I needed to do something that was secure and could pay the bills, you know. And so I went to Emory University. I majored in creative writing to kind of, you know, satisfy that creative side, and then double majoring in journalism to satisfy, you know, my parents' side. And so, so I majored in journalism, and it was with the help of the Asian American Journalists Association. They helped me get a scholarship. And it was kind of easy because, you know, there aren't really that many Asians majoring in journalism anyways. And so they were just like, you want a scholarship? And so I was like, yeah, sure. And so then that kind of like, was like, oh, I could, you know, graduate and get into this field. And at the awards banquet was where I had it in my head. I was like, I'm going to meet someone who's going to give me an internship at CNN.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I met someone, and she kind of became my mentor. And she was like, "Yeah, you can become my intern," because you know, it wasn't until later that I found out that getting an internship at CNN was like really, really hard. And so that organization gave me like a foot in the door, and like I'm forever thankful for that.
God, I'm having goosebumps. Just gratitude, you know?
Yeah.
Organizations like that, and many times those organizations are put together by people with such high ideals to forward the sort of the mm-hmm. community, right? And it pays off. It shows, right? Like, and was that woman who gave you the internship, was she Asian?
Yeah, she was Vietnamese too. Her name was Kim Boy, and I think she still is like the highest ranking Asian American there at CNN. So to have access to her like that, is amazing. And even now, like when I'm now on the board of the Asian American Journalists Association in LA, and I was the member of the year last year too. So I've given back because they've given me so much.
So Kim Bui, you meet there, right? And this mm-hmm. is your first year in college, or how far along in college are you?
Pretty late. This is, I interned there my senior year. So I was kind of like really scrambling, like trying to figure out what I wanted to do mm-hmm. with my life.
So you meet Kim Bui, she's like, okay, come intern with me. What is that mm-hmm. like? You just email her back like, hey, I'm here, I'm ready to go. And then she's like, all right, well, come in. Can you tell me about like sort of that process?
Yeah, so it's still a formal process, but the fact that, you know, she had my name, she could, and I went through like applications and everything, but because she had my name, she could, she contacted, you know, the internship coordinator and said, Hugh, I pick her out. She's going to be working with me. And yeah, so that's how that worked.
Yeah. So then she's
very thankful for it.
Yeah. So you come and you work for her, and what is it that what did she do at the time at CNN? Mm-hmm. And what did you do for her as an intern?
Yeah. So she is the executive producer of the special projects team at CNN. And so they handle a lot of what we would call now branded content. They worked alongside with the marketing. So whenever like sales and marketing would bring in sponsors, then they would create content that would then be branded, like sponsored by, you know, Chevrolet or some company like that. And so they were very, I think, ahead of the curve on that, you know. And so I would help with research, and I was also given opportunities to write scripts as well. And by the end of that year-long sponsorship, I had completed three produced packages that I could put on my reel in order to show other companies once I graduated. And so to have, you know, to say as a college graduate, to have a reel that includes things that you've already produced for CNN puts you even more ahead of the pack. Yeah. And that helped tremendously. So,
mm-hmm. So then after you graduate, do you sort of just become part of the CNN team? Do they just take you in?
So I, after I graduated, with news, you know, you always have to like start at the bottom and work your way up. And so I landed a news trainee program at a local station in Atlanta. And so, and I worked with the marketing and promotions department. And so they would make like the commercials, and they would make the promos for on air and everything. And so that that training program lasted for about a year. And then after that, I applied for the CNN video journalist program. And so that is their kind of like entry level position for anyone who wants to, you know, work at CNN. And a video journalist is someone who at the time we had, they kind of help like floor direct and kind of act as a PA.
Right.
And so, and the level up from that is a fees coordinator. And for that, you pretty much, this is back in the day when they still use tapes. And so you would just press and record video clips all day long. And it was funny because I came in thinking I was applying for the video journalist position, but they saw all the experience they had. And so they bumped me up to fees coordinator. So I was like, oh, that's good. So, yeah.
Did you ever think that you wanted to be in front of the camera, or is it just always sort of producing behind the camera?
Yeah, at that point in my life, I always wanted to just be behind the camera, because as anyone knows, like the producer has like the most control. I never thought of being in front at all.
It's just something that didn't cross your mind, right?
Yeah, it didn't, because you know, someone like me, like, you know, I didn't think I looked like the people they would hire, you know, who were, you know, white, who were, you know, everything not me. So.
Wow. So that was actually going on in your mind. You're like, I don't want to be in front of the camera because I just don't look like that. I'm not built for that.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, you know, like they're, you know, looking for like a bubbly personality and you know, I consider myself more, you know, for lack of a better word, like more in my head, like just more introverted and more, you know, yet not an extrovert at all. So
quiet and not like really mm-hmm. on air or on screen personality.
Yeah, but now I feel like I feel the trend has moved towards more, you know, not like, hey, well, you know, it moves towards more relatable, like people who are, you know, a little more serious. And so that kind of like, that is what kind of like changed it for me. So that I didn't have to be this like bubbly, perky personality. Not that there's nothing wrong with that, but that just, you know, was not me.
So you're saying it's more like, now it's more authentic, like they just want somebody genuine. But let me ask you this, when did that change? When did you start thinking differently? Because was there a trigger mm-hmm. in the CNN space or the TV space that you're like, oh, that person, I can be like that?
I think it was more out of like necessity. Like, you know, I wanted to do all these projects, but I don't have like the, you know, the budget or the resources to hire someone on air. So, you know what, I'm just going to do it myself. So that's where that came out of, was just, yeah, necessity. And, you know, the tide changing towards more like, you know, like someone like Anthony Bourdain, you know, he's not bubbly. He's not like perky. Like he's kind of snarky and more intellectual, and people gravitated towards that. So.
How long were you at CNN for?
I was there for a little over a decade. So I spent, I spent really most of my career there. So
it's a long time.
Yeah.
It's a long time for anybody to stay at any company like that these days.
Yeah, but I think, you know, but even though I was there for 10 years, it wasn't like I stayed in the same position, you know, like I was a feeds coordinator for maybe 6 months, and they kind of made that position so horrible that like if you were, you know, productive, like you wanted to get out of that position because it was an entry level position. And so they were really looking for people who were like hungry and who wanted to like move out and find ways to like move up. And so I was just there for like 6 months. And then there was another position called media coordinator, like another step up the rung, you know, and was there for six months. And then I was an associate producer in the creative marketing group for around like 3 years, and then became a producer by like my late 20s. And so that's kind of the trajectory at CNN. Like they have certain steps.
Okay, so you are an associate producer, you said, for 3 years, right?
Yeah. Oh, and then I moved up to producer, yeah, and then to senior producer.
So. Okay, so I want to know, because I've never talked to anybody who was an associate producer, a producer, and then a senior producer. Like, what are the three differences, like, in the stratas, right? Like, as an associate producer, what does that entail? What is that different from being a producer? And then what is a producer different being a senior producer?
Yeah, so with associate producer, it's mostly really helping out, you know, the like next level, being the producer. Like I was still doing producing, you know, I was still writing and I was still putting packages together and, you know, and supervising edits and everything. And just edit level of responsibilities, you know, because, you know, as an associate producer, if I get in trouble for something, then, you know, the person who would get in trouble is the producer. Yeah. And so that's, you know, that level of responsibility and accountability comes with, you know, each rung up the ladder, mostly, you know.
So
and
by the, doing, oh, go ahead. The work, you're basically doing the work, but not really taking the hit for the responsibility.
Yeah. And getting paid less too, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And then as an associate producer, what sort of segments were you producing at the time?
So with the creative marketing group, like they did a lot of the creative for CNN, whether it was branded content or commercials or promos. And so I did a lot of the what's called interstitials, which is the daily promos where tonight on Larry King Live we have blah 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 blah. And so that was for associate producer. And then with producer, you would move more into the bigger projects, like the launch campaigns for Larry King Live or Anthony Bourdain. So you came up with, you know, the branding messages for it and kind of the project management of, you know, putting all the pieces of the puzzle together.
And then the senior producer?
And then with the senior producer, it was more creative direction. So your vision, it kind of trickles down to for everyone else to
This sounds like you were doing it. It was like more of the promo side. But did you ever get into producing like actual news segments or, you know, stuff like Anthony Bourdain's actual, like him going to places to shoot?
Yeah, that's something I've always wanted to do, but it's such like a different beast itself, you know, and I feel like the things that I'm doing now is more like that. Yeah. But the fact that I have that background in like the marketing and promoting, like I can like promote the hell out of something, you know, as opposed to someone who is just, you know, a producer on the show, they wouldn't really like understand like what would compel like an audience to like watch it. So I feel like I have, you know, so much more to offer now. So yeah, because of that,
I can imagine, like, if you know what people are wanting to watch, you can actually produce something that people want to watch.
Yeah,
and you can actually market the thing you want to watch.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think made people want to watch something like Bourdain?
I think it goes back to, you know, that authenticity. You know, he's not, you know, fluff, you know, he is really interested in knowing about a culture, and he is also like an amazing writer, and so he has such like a distinct point of view, and he was, you know, showing people a different side of a community or a country that you normally don't see. And you know, up to that point, a lot of like food media was that aspirational, you know, and he was more of like the nitty gritty. And I think that really brought in like a new audience who didn't want that fluff and who really wanted to experience how life is in another country through food.
were there multiple people that CNN would groom or train or sort of process through the ranks that would become like a Bourdain? Like at any given time, did CNN do, you know, there's 10 guys like Bourdain, and then we just don't know about him until it like, until they become like ripe or mature, and then CNN just pushes them out. So is there like a training program, or they just contractually find somebody at that level already and then they just bring them in?
I think like, I can't speak too much about like the talent, but from, you know, from what my own experience is, like take for example, Anderson Cooper, you know, like he, before like his watershed moment was Katrina, like that is what put him on the map. Would you say he was being like groomed for that type of, you know, for that? Not at all, you know. Or like a Don Lemon, like he just was a daily news anchor, and now he's such
a voice.
Speaking out against, you know, injustice. Like that is that's almost kind of on their own initiative, you know. So I mean CNN is always looking for talent, and but you can't really predict that, you know. You don't have a crystal ball to see who is going to like rise to the occasion, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, because I mean, you have the rise of, you know, all of the police brutality, and Don Lemon gets his chance, and Cooper with Katrina, and he gets his shot. Were there any Asian Americans, or specifically any Vietnamese, during those years that were sort of on their way up?
Yeah, there was Betty Nguyen.
Yeah,
she worked when I was at CNN. She I think it was the first Asian, first Vietnamese American woman to be on cable as a news anchor. And she was very accessible, and we actually knew each other. And so she would give me advice and everything when I was still like an associate producer. And so, yeah, you know, it's all about like helping the next generation. So I was, I don't know if she remembers me now, but I was really thankful for that, for her time and, you know, giving me advice.
And if it was like, now that I'm hearing and processing what you're saying, to go from a Betty Nguyen to a Don Lemon or Anderson Cooper, Betty would probably had to have step up into some situation, some world catastrophe or something, right? And then she would have to kind of put her voice out there to really catapult it to the next level.
I guess you could say that. Like, I think for her watershed moment did happen when I remember distinctly she was one of the few journalists who gained access to Myanmar during like a time it had like a coup or uprising or something, you know. So yeah, it's all about, like for me, I had a watershed moment too, if I can share it.
I would love to hear that. I was going to ask you.
Because this is what like really put me on the map at CNN and like put me like on the fast track. So I was still an associate producer at the time, and Anderson Cooper was doing a special for World Refugee Day. And so I found that out through like my supervisor. I was like, oh, whoa, that's cool. And I was like, I don't know if you know, but I'm a refugee. And then he was like, what? You don't look like a refugee. And so that kind of like started these wheels spinning in my head, because, you know, just because I don't, because I think people, when they think of refugees, they have a very certain like image, you know, of like kids and families in these war-torn countries. And but then, you know, there is life after that, you know, and I'm kind of like a product of that. And so when, so the project that I pitched to my boss at the time was, I wanted to also highlight other CNN employees who used to be former refugees to show, you know, everyone that, to show a different definition of what it means to be a refugee. And that's what is so great about CNN, is that it's such like a global company, and it values all these different backgrounds. And so the people that I highlighted was one woman who was a producer from Nigeria, and another was a woman who family escaped the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, and another from an Eastern European company. And at the time, Rick Sanchez, his family escaped from Cuba. Like, he was an anchor at CNN. And so it really opened up people's eyes, you know, and I had to like pitch this up the ranks to these executive producers. So here I am, like an associate producer, and like 24 years old, like pitching to all these higher ups, and they, you know, they get behind it and they become my advocates for the project. And so that was what really put me on the map. And like the next year, like I became a producer, like that was what I wanted. So yeah.
You're this associate producer, you're doing your daily job. You have this idea because you were triggered in a way, in a good way, by Anderson, mm-hmm. Cooper, right? So you have this idea, you're like, okay, I'm going to go home and I'm going to write this stuff up and I'm going to put it. But then how are you, like, the executive producers that you pitch to, is it one person, three people, is it different teams? How do you go about presenting within the company?
Yeah, it's so I first pitched the idea to my immediate supervisor, and then we pitched it to his boss, which is kind of the you know, the boss of the whole department. And she goes and with me in the room, like, because now she's my advocate, and that's so important, is having advocates. And so she's like, hey, I've got this, you know, up and coming superstar associate producer, and she has a great idea, and, you know, I want to share it with you, and we think we should do it. And so and that's how it happened.
And then you have this idea. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, it's just, I think as a young person, like, it's so important to have advocates. Yeah. And yeah.
So you have it all written up, and you go and you show these different teams, and mm-hmm. you get it actually produced.
Yeah, so this was a print campaign. And so this was where I produced the these like posters that would be shown all over the bureaus of CNN, like in the Beijing bureau, and the London and Paris bureau. So, yeah. Yeah.
And then so did you have to get permission from the people that you're spotlighting? Did you have to go talk to them first, and you're like, oh, I have this idea? And then how did you even know that they were refugees?
I just, through, you know, word of mouth, I would be like, hey, do you guys know any coworkers who used to be refugees? And from there it was just like a snowball effect, because this was a project that everyone wanted to get on board with, you know, because it's so different from what we normally do. And yeah, that's what I just loved about working at CNN, was just how international the employees were there, you know, and as big as it was still pretty
small.
Yeah, pretty small and tight. So I didn't have any problems finding subjects at all.
What were some of the challenges and the difficulties of working for a company like CNN?
I think one of the biggest one is that, because it's such a big and global company, is that you might feel as if you're like a small little cog, or small, you know, just one part of a bigger machine. But I felt like with that project that one person can make a difference, you know, and make a huge difference. And so that's what I love about it, that even that it's such a big company, and that even though you think like one person can't make an impact, they can.
Yeah. But what about the challenges?
Oh, challenges. I think the same thing is that it's such a big company that you think you can't make a difference. And I mean, yeah, there were, you know, levels of bureaucracy and everything, but I think at the end of the day, like, you know, because we were so committed to, you know, reporting the news, like you can't just, you know, breaking news happens and you can't go through like 10 layers of tape to get the story on air, you know? And so the people who work there are like, you know, the best of the best. And
what do you think of all of the sort of polarity of, you know, like a CNN or a Fox, and the branding and the sort of the differences in the direction that they take?
If I feel since I've left, it's now more like a proliferation. You know, there's before it was just, you know, CNN, Fox News, NBC, and there's so many more different platforms. It's not just television anymore. People get their news from Twitter or Facebook now, you know, it's so segmented in a way that it wasn't before. And that truth, you know, the idea of what is truth, you know, because there aren't like gatekeepers anymore, you know. So it's, as you know, I don't want to get into like politics, but you know, as the last election has shown, is like we need accountability in how we get our news, or else, you know, because people see it out there, they just assume that it's, you know, true, and that's, you know, not the case.
What made you leave?
It was more for personal reasons. I got married, and you know, I think after like 10 years, like I wanted to also do projects that interest me, and I was getting a little like burnout from the daily news cycle. So
yeah, it sounds like a grind. Everybody I talk to in that business, sounds very difficult sometimes to be.
Yeah, honest. Especially with, you know, the big T word.
Yeah. Say no more. And then, so when you made the decision to leave, did you have a plan? Did you like, okay, this is what I'm going to do next? And then a year later, you planned to jump? Or did you just stop and then just went right into what you wanted to do?
I took a sabbatical for my first year. Like, so while I was working at CNN, I also got my MFA in poetry from NYU. And so when I left CNN, I focused on my MFA, graduated from that. And then right after graduation, I got a fellowship for poetry at Pepperdine University in Malibu for a summer. And so that was just kind of like reaffirming that my life was moving away from news and towards more of the creative side, you know? And so, when I was at the fellowship, my poetry mentor there, her name is Nina Alexander. Sadly, she like passed away, but, you know, I remember telling her, like, you know, I love writing poetry, but I just feel like, you know, it needs to move forward somehow. Like, I feel like it shouldn't just be on the written word. And so she introduced me to all these like short films that are based on poetry. And so that was where the impetus for like being like a filmmaker started to come into play. Like, oh, I can make, you know, these weird short films out of my favorite poetry and everything. And so those were my first films, are these like weird, like avant-garde that I hope no one will ever see. So,
well, look, I need to explore this whole poetry side, because I think I've read that's what you went to New York for your MFA, but that's like that's a huge life decision, going from making money into something, an MFA, not making money. But what do you get? Like, what was the thought process to get an MFA in poetry?
I always, like, you know, I was always like, you know, I, like I was saying, like in my earlier like life, like I wanted to be like an artist, I wanted to be creative, but then you have, you know, having to make a living, and so that took over, you know, took over my life, was, you know, having a career. And so that creativity side had to, you know, take a back seat. And so I had the luxury of being able to like take some time off, you know, taking that year off and pursuing that.
So. And that was a one-year program to get the MFA in poetry?
No, the MFA was a 2-year program. Like it was a low residency. So while I was like working at CNN, I was still like pursuing it. And then when I left CNN, like then I graduated and then got the fellowship.
Okay. When I think about poetry or film or anything creative, I think of, sometimes I think of like, there's a lot of structure in film. You could make the same argument with poetry, that there's structure. In my head, I don't see it, because I'm not from that world, the poet, you know. But how much structure really is there? Like, what do you really, what is the difference between like spending, let's say, 5 years just like grinding it out writing poetry versus somebody who gets their MFA? What is the difference in sort of the product?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, when their idea of poetry is like, oh, it's just, you know, there's really no structure to it. But, you know, like the nitty gritty of it, like even writing like one line that's suddenly structure, where like wherever you put punctuation, that's still considered structure, you know. So for me, I guess coming from that world, like it's absolutely like based on structure, even though it might, you know, and that's, I think it's done its job if, you know, people, if it's so effortless that it feels like there's no structure. So yeah,
I'm still trying to process that.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a whole thought process, you know, like, yeah, I think, you know, I think there's this, you know, idea of like poets who just, you know, write whatever comes out of their head, but there's so much like editing and so much, you know, rewriting that goes into creating poetry.
This is a random question, but is there any sort of study alongside like legit poetry and perhaps rap during your program at all?
You know, like that's one of the one things that I feel is lacking within, you know, the study of poetry, is that the idea of, you know, bringing in other mediums. Because yeah, like rap is based on rhymes and it's based on the musicality. And you know, I think with a lot of things that are having like having a reckoning right now, like definitely the academic community, the literary community is also having to like reevaluate like who gets to, you know, who gets to write these stories and who gets to be published. And Yeah, and for a long time, you know, it was very white, you know, but now it's there's opportunities for like people of color, and for like spoken word is one thing that comes to mind, like of taking, you know, poetry and performance and putting it together. And I think there needs to be more of that, or else, you know, poetry is going to be like a dying art form. And again, and that was what I wanted to do, you know, take the world of film and the world of poetry and for a new audience.
And merge the two. How often do you write poetry now?
Sadly, I focus so much time on like writing scripts now that I I haven't written like poetry in a long time, but I will tell you this, a lot of the best like TV writers do have a poetry background, just because poetry teaches you how, like the economy of words, like, you know, keep everything as tight as possible and to say so much in so little. And so I feel like everything that I've learned in poetry really helps with my script writing. So.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Ocean Vuong.
Oh, yeah. I had I unfortunately never got a chance to meet him when I did in Paris, and I'm kicking myself that I never did. So,
well, let's talk about that. Your project with Paris. So how did it begin? What inspired your documentary?
So for me, I was a late bloomer to travel. I didn't start, Paris was the first city outside of, no, yeah, first European city that I traveled to. And so, I think I've always had like a fascination and a love affair with Paris. Like with my MFA, it was a low residency program, which meant that, you know, we would have workshops in, workshops in Paris. Like we would spend like 2 weeks for a winter residence and 2 weeks for a summer residence. And so I've been to Paris like eight or nine times now. So not that that makes me a expert in any way, but you know, each time I would come to Paris, it wasn't as like a tourist, you know, it was as, you know, a student, as someone, you know, being immersed in that culture. And yeah, the first time I came to Paris, I was just so shocked that there was like a Vietnamese community there, you know, and that was so fascinating to me to have like pho in Paris and have it taste just as good, and a banh mi there too. My mind was like completely blown away because, you know, my background being from like Georgia, like I never even knew that there were like communities in other countries, and that stayed with me every time I would go to Paris, I would go to Wang Mu Ba, and it felt like I was, you know, at home in a foreign place. Yeah. You know, because I didn't speak French, and not a lot of people, you know, spoke English. And then here I am able to communicate in like Vietnamese to, you know, another Vietnamese person. And so that was kind of when you're feeling like homesick, you know. So
wait a minute, let me get this straight. You go to Paris for the first time, right? And you really don't know the sort of the historical context of what Vietnamese people are doing there, or whenever they got there, that there's even a community. But what did you do? Like open up a restaurant guidebook, or how did you discover that there was this community in Paris?
I was just feeling homesick, and I just looked, you know, on Yelp for like pho places, just out of like, oh, let's see if there's like Vietnamese food here. And because I mean, I knew that they're, you know, because of our history, you know, French colonialism and everything, that there is a history. And so But I knew that there was some there was a connection, and then it wasn't until I got to Paris and I was like, oh, there's a whole like district there, and that was really eye-opening.
Yeah, I have been talking to several older members of our Vietnamese community who've been in Paris since the 50s. They left as young men, like way before the war. And I've interviewed several of these men, and it is mind-blowing to think that even before my parents were born, you know, they had relationships with, you know, Vietnam, and France had, you know, they were sending military personnel back to France to train in the Navy, in the army, in the military, and then they would bring them and post them back in Vietnam, and it would just be a completely French thing, you know.
Yeah, and
this existed for a long time, and obviously it led to, you know, a lot of, you know, conflicts that that produces what was the modern, you know, Vietnam War. But yeah, in the 50s, it was a big group of Vietnamese students that went to France, and some of them never left.
There's so many of those stories and more, and I want to learn more about those, you know, and I can't wait until like COVID is over so that we can like start traveling again.
What inspired you to sort of hone in on the food and not some other aspect of the Vietnamese French experience?
Like, I've always been a foodie growing up, even like when I was, you know, a little girl in like South Georgia. Like, I would look, you know, at PBS, and I would look watch the travel and food channels, and you know, this was before like being a foodie was like a cool thing, and I was fascinated with like truffles and caviar. And so it was because, you know, I've being a lifelong foodie, and you know, one of the people that I admired the most was Anthony Bourdain, you know, and the way that he told stories through food. And all of that, like, I knew the story that I wanted to tell was through food, because even in, you know, Vietnamese culture, like, food is such a big thing, and it's around food that people really like open up and let their guard down. And yeah, so that's why I felt like this is, you know, the best way to tell these stories.
So you have this idea that's kind of like brewing in your mind, right? Mm-hmm. And then you write a treatment, or you write some description of this idea, but how does it go from like this idea to like this finished 15-minute short documentary?
Yeah, I was prefaced by saying like, this is not how you go about making a documentary. because coming from, you know, like CNN and making, you know, the longest thing I ever produced was, you know, a couple minutes. Yeah, going from like producing something that's a couple minutes to producing something that is, you know, like is 15 minutes is, it's kind of a stretch, you know. So there's that knowledge gap that I had to quickly learn, because how you tell a story in, you know, a short amount of time is so different from how you tell a story in.
How is it different?
It's, you know, for example, like doing commercial, it's like finding that little nugget, and it's like bang, 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 you know. But with something, you know, a longer piece, you get to really fill it up with space. And for me, that was the challenge of like, how do, you know, I fill it up. And I did write like a treatment, and I did write like a rough script, just because, yeah, you still have to have like a roadmap to figure out what you want to shoot. And I already had interview questions, and I already had interview subjects in mind. And so I think, what, you know, documentary, it's more of really, the story doesn't happen until, you know, the camera really starts rolling, because you don't really know, you know, what their stories are. I mean, you might have like a preconceived notion of like what the story is, but I think it's that element of discovery that is really different from like for documentary as opposed to like a traditional film, is having that spontaneity to keep, you know, the camera rolling for these unexpected but like magical moments that right. you didn't even realize were going to happen.
Did you come into the project with sort of like a thesis, an idea that you wanted to kind of talk about? Or were you just like, all right, let me just go in and shoot a bunch of restaurant owners and see where the story unfolds?
Mm-hmm. I think my overall thesis was that I really wanted to like highlight a community that hasn't really, that, you know, because I'm Vietnamese, because we're Vietnamese that we seek out, but like someone who's like an American tourist, like, would not have any idea. So it was more of really, you know, highlighting their stories. And I think it was more of just, you know, just having an overarching theme. I just wanted to, you know, discover what was out there, which it can be a good and a bad thing, you know, if you're too unstructured, but yeah, it, and you know, because this was also my like first documentary, I had no idea what I was doing. So, well, some idea, but you know.
Yeah, when you say that, what do you mean by that? Like, you had no idea. Like, what didn't you know that you think you should have known going in?
You know, like that's something that I should have had more confidence in, you know, like I have this background of producing at CNN for like over 10 years, like I know what I'm doing, you know, but it's just, you know, the idea of, you know, that label of like filmmaker, of director, it feels so like mythical. It feels like it belongs to somebody else, you know, and maybe it's, you know, because I suffer from imposter syndrome a lot. And so I never think of myself as like, oh, I'm good enough to be labeled this.
Yeah.
So.
I think that happens with a lot of us in the sort of creative fields, right? It's just part of it. Mm-hmm. And I would venture to say that a lot of people do have it. And then there are people that don't have it. You know, there's the guys that don't have mm-hmm. it, but then there are most of us that do have it. And I can't speak for the people that have it, but I can speak for the people who have imposter syndrome like me. And what I've learned over the years is imposter syndrome sometimes is beneficial because it helps puts us in check. Sort of like, mm-hmm. okay, you better double check your shit and make sure like whatever you're putting out is quality, and just go over it over and over and over and over again. So then when you do put it out, you know, you've done your best to kind of put that work out. And then if you don't have you might just like, I'm good. I'm like, I'm, you know, you're so confident. You're like, ah, I'm good. And you don't check it. And that could be a problem mm-hmm. too. So,
I think that's a great way of looking at it, you know?
Yeah. I've embraced it because I'm definitely on that, imposter syndrome, bus. I'm on it and I deal with it a lot. I deal with it daily in my life. You know, am I doing the right thing? Am I creatively putting out something that's quality? It's always there. Mm-hmm. How did you find the subjects that were in your documentary?
Yeah, a lot of it was, you know, I only, so it's funny, like my husband was telling me like he was going to Paris like in a month. And then that was when I was like, oh, I'm going to go shoot a documentary in a month. You know? And so I only had like really a month of pre-planning for everything. So that meant, you know, like,
I'm going to go shoot a documentary in a month. Like, he's like, I'm going to go in a month. And you're like, I'm going to go in a month.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, this would be like the perfect opportunity to like shoot. But again, like that, you know, the idea of it was always like in the back of my mind and like, oh, this is an opportunity that's just presented itself, you know?
Yeah.
And so I only had I had a month of prep to find
crew,
find my DP, find like a fixer there, find like an audio person, like pretty much like putting together a crew, you know, remotely, and also looking for subjects remotely, and being an outsider, you know, and not knowing like you're not really knowing anyone there. And for the subjects, it was mostly like googling Vietnamese restaurants and just reaching out and being like, hey, can I shoot? Can I tell your story? Most of them I met was just through googling and making a cold email introduction and having them say yes.
Wow. And ultimately, did you get the things that you wanted to get? Did the experience turn out the way you had imagined it?
I think for the most part, it did. Like I think if the things that if I could go back, do differently is probably my interview style. Like at this point, I was like, oh, I'm Anthony Bourdain. I'm just gonna like shoot it with my interview subject, and we're just gonna like have a conversation over a meal. And I mean,
was that harder to pull off than what you had imagined, being like a Bourdain?
Well, what I should have done was like actually just sit down and like interview them. So then I would have like coverage, like so much more coverage than, you know, as opposed to just interviewing them over a meal. So that's, I think that's the main thing, like moving forward, to always just like do like a one-on-one interview and then do the other stuff. So
got it.
But yeah, but I was like, I'm Anthony Bourdain. But no, I'm not.
Wait, so I think in your mind you were like, okay, let me pull this off like Bourdain, right? But then you get there and you turn the camera on and it rolls and you realize, okay, I'm not Bourdain. But then what, I think what in your mind and when in your mind did you go, okay, this is a lot harder than it looks?
Because we had such like, we only had like 5 days of shooting. And so there was no time to like really pre-interview. And so pretty much when we got there, we set up, everything was like, you know, bam, we're doing the interview, as opposed to like really having time to do several interviews, you know, and really knowing, you know, all these amazing like people a little more intimately, you know. So, but I feel like I feel like I was still able to like draw out stories from them. So,
do you think?
So I mean, yeah, it wasn't a.
Do you think Bourdain gets more time?
Yeah, like he's, yeah. You know, I mean, they would like pre-interview the subjects and everything, so that he kind of already has like an idea of what, you know, talking points and everything. They would spend hours lighting, you know, before they even filmed. So it was, you know, even though like it looks like, oh, they just came in and came out, but
literally,
you know, because the production value was so high, like, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like it's like everything's on the fly, you know, oh, like we just found something, or we just got the call and hey, we're going to head out to that village.
Yeah, that's not the case.
So you spend 5 days to shoot this, this documentary, and you finish it, you go back and you edit it, and what happens after that?
Okay, so this is where like the imposter syndrome comes in again, because I feel like I'm such a failure that everything I shot is horrible that I don't look at the footage for at least a couple months. Because I don't, you know, because, yeah, because, you know, that imposter syndrome, you're like, oh, I don't want to look at it because I know, you know, the footage is going to suck. And so to avoid feeling that, I just, you know, but luckily I have like accountability partners who are like, come on, Hugh, it's not that bad. Just look at the footage, put it together, you know. And this is again where like, so I look at the footage and I'm like, oh, okay, it's not that bad. And then, you know, when it comes time to edit it, like I, you know, one of the first things you should have is like a team in place, and I don't have a team in place. So I'm scrambling to look for an editor, and like one of the main things is like, because a lot of these interviews are in Vietnamese, and because, you know, this is, you know, for us, by us, like we should have, you know, an editor who's Vietnamese. And so that's kind of like finding a needle in a haystack. But luckily I I found, well, so the editor is Richard Van, who is like in his own right is also an amazing like filmmaker. And I worked on one of his short films as an executive producer. And coincidentally, it's also called My Name Hugh, but he didn't name it because I was an executive producer. But, and so, and I was telling him like, hey, do you know of any like editor who's Vietnamese? And he was like, I am, I can do it for you. And I was like, oh, you know, serendipitously, great. You know, someone I know and trust and who has like a great vision and creative style. And so we worked together for about 6 months editing the film, which is like way too long for like a 15 minute film. But again, imposter syndrome, and like I put it off, I don't want to look at it because I think it's going to suck. But you know, because we just wanted to like put something together as quickly as possible, you know, so that's why it's like 15 minutes. But we have so much more like footage, and so I want to create a director's cut that is 22-23, you know, broadcast length, because that's where I kind of want it to go next, is to get it on like PBS or somewhere on air. So
got it. Did you ever have to go back to Paris for pickup shots or anything?
Luckily no, but then that wasn't, you know, that wasn't an option, you know. What I have is what I have to work with. So
right. And then now, how would people watch this? How did it get out into the, has it gotten out to the world to see?
So first we're still in the film festival stage, so that's why it's not like readily available yet. Like the first screening for it was at the Nguyen Việt Community Center, and they've been so instrumental in helping support the film, you know, because this is for, you know, the Vietnamese community, and to have like Nguyen Việt behind it is so like humbling, and I'm very grateful for that too.
When did you release it to is it Bao Nguyen Việt?
That was in 2019. Yeah, 2019 was when it had its screening, initial screening with Nguyen Việt, and then like the 2020 last year was when it got into like the different festivals, like all the world. And but because of the pandemic, I wasn't able to like attend any of the film screenings, not even the one in, you know, in LA for the Los Angeles Pacific Asian American. That one like was so dear to my heart because, you know, it's right in our hometown, and I really wanted, I wish the festival was, you know, in person as opposed to virtual.
Did you submit it to the Vietnamese Film Festival?
I did, but, you know, because of the pandemic, they postponed it for 2020 and hopefully we'll have like another one for
Yeah,
they'll come they're coming back for
this year. Yeah.
2021.
Oh, okay. So we can all see it at the Vietnamese Film Festival this year, 2021.
Hopefully if it gets selected, we'll see. So
Exciting.
can't
That's
promise
cool.
anything.
Yeah. Why did you just decide to make, like, in the beginning, why did you think, like, oh, I'll just make a short one instead of like a full long one, like a feature length one?
I think it's because I wanted to, baby steps. Like first I was, producing content that was a couple minutes, and now this is longer. And then I think, that being, 20, 25 minutes. So I wanted to do everything kind of like in baby steps, but but like in hindsight, I should have just made it, broadcast length.
So you've grown up in Georgia. You've been living in LA for a while. You've been to Paris and the Vietnamese district. Have you been back to Vietnam yet? And if so, what was that like?
Yeah, that is the number one place that I want to go to, once the pandemic is over. And I want to have a film crew with me and document that experience. And I really want to go back with my parents because they haven't been back in 40 years, and to just get their reaction and how, they feel about going back too.
Are
So,
they open to it?
it's kind of like they are open to it, but they've been away so long. Like I think it's going to be like a culture shock for them. There's still so much for them to also unpack, all the things that they left behind that they would have to, confront and everything. So it's going to be like very, yeah, it's so much to unpack for everyone. So, yeah.
Now, when you think about the sort of like people from Vietnamese from Georgia, from LA, from Paris, do you see any similarities and differences in the people, in the Vietnamese people?
Yeah, I think there is a big difference in terms of yeah, I'm gonna have to unpack this one. Like the Vietnamese community in Georgia, because I really didn't have a community in Georgia. The only one I could talk about is kind of like the one in Atlanta. And for that, it was mostly from my like I wasn't really immersed in that Vietnamese community in Georgia either. If anything, it was through the food mostly. And then in LA, of course, there's Little Saigon. And for me, because of like Nguyen Việt, I feel like I'm closer to that Vietnamese community. But there's still a lot of struggle of my identity because I don't speak, as fluent Vietnamese as someone who grew up, and I don't write the language. Like it feels like I'm not Vietnamese enough for Orange County,
Yeah,
I don't know.
no, I get it. That's a very fair self-assessment, you know? I think that language is a bridge into another, you know, it's a cliche, but it's a bridge into another world. And if you don't speak that language, it's very tough to navigate culturally in that world, that universe. So I completely get it. And there's levels to all of this too. There's like, you know, there's levels. There's just not like, you know, it's just not like either you got it or you don't, but in between you either have it or you don't. There's like levels inside of it as well. There's nuances to it that I'm learning every day that it's deep.
And for the community in Paris, I think coincidentally, I feel the most welcome there just because, you know, compare it to like the communities in Georgia and in Little Saigon, because it's such a smaller pocket, like it feels more welcoming because there's so little of you that when you like see someone who's like you, it's like, oh, I found like another cousin, another, you know, family member. So it's very like, you know, welcoming and come in, as opposed to, you know, as opposed to a place where it's such a bigger community, you know?
Yeah, I think that there's a good point. It's Orange County has a certain, you know, there's a strength in numbers, and in the strength in numbers, they don't really think that, you know, that there's people like who have Vietnamese blood who really can't speak it. And then if you can't speak it, there's no forgiveness for that, right? There's just like, I mean, it's just human nature. You know, it's like they won't have sort of this empathy for somebody who comes from, I mean, basically outside of the community, right? Because we all, you know, if you're from Orange County, I grew up in Koreatown, but Koreatown in LA, but I've spent my whole life going, you know, obviously family and friends in Orange County and partying in Orange County as a young man, that there's a certain expectation, cultural expectation. And I think Paris might be like Vietnamese, French Vietnamese would be more sort of inclined to be more open and curious, you know, a Vietnamese American, right? And so there's like sort of that cushion, that, you know, that space in between our cultures that will allow for them to, because every time I met somebody from France, there's like a mutual sort of curiosity and interest, whereas like somebody in OC, there's this sort of like, you know, there's just, again, there's this identity that's already baked into, you know, 40 something years of a community down there. That's you know, it's a tight community too.
Yeah.
So what's next for you?
Yeah. So one of it is I want to, you know, turn the short film into like broadcast length and get it on like a PBS or streaming. I'm developing another documentary that's also based on food and Vietnamese culture. I really want to do something with fish sauce for some reason. Like, I feel like for some reason, that's what my next documentary is beyond, because I feel like it's so like misunderstood, especially with like, you know, Western palates. They see it as only this like one note. Oh, it's stinky. And I want to like change that perception. Like, why can't it be as nuanced as when people talk about olive oil, or when people talk about wine? Because there's, you know, because the terroir plays such a big part in it. So that's one that I'm developing. And I'm also getting into developing TV shows. I've written several pilots, and hoping to get those produced. You know, because now is such a big time for, you know, Asian American voices. Like, I feel like finally the doors are opening up, and we have so many, well, I have so many stories to tell that, you know, that's for me the natural progression is to get, is going to television again. So.
Yeah, that fish sauce thing is interesting, because you brought up olive oil, and you brought up what did you just bring up? You brought up two Italian things. You said you brought
wine.
Up and wine, both sort of beautiful in Italian culture. And why can't fish sauce be, you know, a normative thing that we find beauty in the world, especially in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of my creative friends were talking about this the other day. Why is it that when we hear broken Vietnamese in English, or is it broken English coming from a Vietnamese person, that it's not as beautiful, or it's not beautiful at all? It's kind of repulsive by the mainstream. Why is that the situation? But when you hear a British or a Italian or French
speaking
English, it's beautiful. It's romantic, right?
Mm.
We got to make that normative. We have to make that a normal thing in the world. And it's not just in the United States. It's like, is it something inherent in our tonal language that makes it not pretty? Is it something inherent in the fish sauce that's stinky? Like, what is the properties of these things that we're talking about that makes it not as attractive as in the Italian culture?
Well, I think a big part of it is how it's like portrayed in the media, you know, and it's always through like, you know, a Western lens and a Western gaze, you know, like when you hear someone with like a French accent speaking English, it's always some like sexy, hot person. But then when you hear like, yeah, the broken English of, you know, of an Asian person, like it's someone who, you know, isn't attractive, is someone who's like a caricature.
Yeah.
And yeah, and I think that has a main thing too. And also, you know, it's been even the self, you know, hatred has been instilled within us, you know, like,
definitely.
You know, growing up in Western society, like, where these are the images that we're confronted in, and you, you know, internalize that. And it's time we, you know, took pride in that and make it and normalize it.
You know, what's sad is I don't know in our lifetime if we're going to be able to normalize it for ourselves. I'm not even talking about for the public, like the mainstream public. Can we normalize it just for ourselves? Because that is probably the most important thing. We're beating the drums like normalize it, make stinky, make fish sauce not stinky, make our tonality beautiful, you know. But we don't even believe it sometimes, right? It's something that we are not confident that fish sauce is not stinky or whatever. So the way I look at it is this. My wife is Taiwanese and she grew up spent a lot of years. She was born in the U.S., but she spent a lot of the years of her formative years, elementary, high school, in Taiwan. And it's a blessing for her because she doesn't have the baggage that we Vietnamese Americans have. And another point is there are kids now that are from Vietnam who came in the mid 2015s or 2018 or 2010, and they came over here as which is international students, come over here and they stay here and they work here and they're professionals here, become architects, they become marketing professionals, they become these professionals in the United States. They don't have the same baggage that we do. And then they stay here for a little bit longer and they begin to accumulate the baggage. So it's like, we have to like start believing it and we have to start marketing the beauty. And it starts with projects like Quang Mui Ba, because you spotlight the beauty of ourselves no matter where we are. We're in Paris and it's beautiful because being in Paris, that's a beautiful romantic whatever, you know, context is.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful place. But hey, we're able to be there and we are able to create beauty there. And so we get to bring that back to the United States. We get to portray that. So fuck the imposter syndrome. You know, you're doing a great job, you know. And I say that because I'm trying to tell myself that too constantly, right? I'm as a creative and somebody who believes in normalizing sort of the beauty of our journey is something that I wanna push with this podcast, The Vietnamese.
Yeah, and I think you're like doing an amazing job. And like, yeah, we need more of us, you know.
Yeah, there's a movement that's happening now. Hugh, thank you so much. I've had a wonderful.
Oh, you still the last question.
I'm getting there.
Oh,
thank you for reminding me. I was gonna wrap it all up, but hey, I appreciate that. So that means that it was brewing in your mind, right? That's great. That's great. I was wrapping it up and I was going to go, hey, thank you so much. And then the last thing is, okay, perfect. So the last thing that I want to talk after talking to you about all these topics today, how is the evolution of being Vietnamese? What does it mean to you today? And has it been an evolution for you? Or do you think it's sort of the same? You've been the same sort of Vietnamese person that you've always been.
Yeah, I think one thing that I really took away from this documentary, and it was really clear with the young people, is that there is so many ways to be Vietnamese, and that it can be fluid. It is not this static thing. Like the thing that the young people would tell me is, when they're with French people, they feel more French than Vietnamese. But when they're with Vietnamese people, they feel more Vietnamese than French. And they were perfectly fine with that. There's no reason to feel ashamed about it at all. And that idea of fluidity, and I think that's something that, us living in the US, or it feels like we view identity too much as black or white. Either we are Vietnamese and we can speak it and we can write it. That's how we know we're Vietnamese. And as opposed to, I might not speak as fluently and I might not write it or read it, but you know what? I still am Vietnamese no matter what. It's my own personal perception of what I want to be. So that's what I took away from the documentary and from like this whole conversation, is that there is so many different ways to be Vietnamese, and that it is fluid, and it's really how you view it as opposed to external factors, imposing their limitations on your own identity.
I look forward to the next few years of the work that you put out.
Thank you. And let's definitely, keep in touch. And I want to learn more about what you do too, and see if there's some type of like synergy involved. So.
Yes, I'm sure there is. There's a big group of creative people in LA. I'm sure you know a lot of them, but I look forward to the stories that you'll be putting out because it seems that you have sort of this big curiosity for, your own, identity and where you're going to, who you're going to become through the stories that you tell. So we look forward to that. We need
Thank you.
more
Thank
people
you
like
for
you.
having me.
Wonderful. And then hopefully we can catch up, when you have another project coming out.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time today, and we'll talk soon.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran and Javier Proenza. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.